For our scripture reading this morning, take your Bibles. Let's turn to Daniel, the 7th chapter. We're going to read the entirety of the 28 verses. This is a dream that Daniel had. See that in verse 1. The first part is going to be the dream, and within the dream, he's going to ask one, it'll be a spirit being, an angel, for help in understanding what this dream means. And this spirit being is going to interpret the dream for him. Now, this was written many centuries ago, but it's for our understanding of putting these things together that we've been looking at in the book of Revelation. You follow along as I read Daniel, the 7th chapter. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now this is going to be Babylon, and this particular man running Babylon at the time is Nebuchadnezzar, and he's going to move from being a beast to a man. That's an improvement up the scale. The latter here, and that reflects what happened back in Daniel chapter 4 when Nebuchadnezzar became a believer. Verse 5, and another beast, a second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth, of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn, that is the little horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things. And I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was like fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. This is reminiscent of the vision that Ezekiel saw in his prophecy. Verse 10, a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. That is, after this fourth beast, or this kingdom, is destroyed, those who make up these other historical kingdoms continue on into the millennial period. Verse 13, I saw in the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by, and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things. Verse 17. These great beasts are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. And of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the others, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, that is, this little horn uprooted three of the ten horns. Even that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after. Excuse me. Shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time, or 3.5 times. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hereto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Does everybody have the handout that we had last week of the heads, horns, and kingdoms? If you don't have it, Eric, can you grab some of those if anybody holds their hand up? What's that?
I have last week.
You have last week's in there too? Okay, there were some on the back table.
But you need to change the date.
Yep. Okay. We've added to the notes that we had last week, so it should say up in the upper left-hand corner, May 31st, 2015. Now, these printed notes are somewhat unique. I've written these out or had these written out. My wife is the one who does the writing or the keyboarding on this. Anyway, I did this with the picture in order to help you understand a difficult portion of Scripture that ties together several passages that we went over quickly last week. We call it heads, horns, and kingdoms. In several places you'll see passages, you'll see multiple heads on an animal. You'll see horns on one of the heads. And we have that all pictured and written out here in these notes. And so we simply want to, I'm going to rehearse this very quickly in review. You can be looking up here when Deanne gets back here again to start showing it on the overhead. But what we've seen so far in Revelation chapter 17 is two diverse types of religious organization. The first half of the tribulation, there's going to be this woman. She's a harlot. Now, this isn't a sexual, physical thing. She's a harlot spiritually. And we went over the passages that demonstrate that there is such a thing as spiritual harlotry. It's kind of blending in some truth and adding a lot of error, which creates total error. And that's what this woman does spiritually. What this is after the rapture. If you remember Matthew chapter 13, you have seven parables, and the second parable was the third parable was the parable of the mustard seed. The mustard seed represents, it's the smallest of seeds, it grows into the greatest of herbs, something about so high and big and so forth, you can get that size. And that represents the true kingdom of the heavens, those who truly belong to that kingdom that were planted there by Christ. These are true believers. But this thing becomes a tree. That parable, the third parable in Matthew 13, tells you the proportionate size of the profession of Christendom to the true reality of believers in Christendom. When the rapture takes place, out of this tree will be missing the size of a mustard plant. So, what's going to be left? Most of Christendom, the larger percentage of Christendom, is going to be left. And so, this remaining element of Christendom is, as it has been doing in many venues, accepting and promoting and trying to incorporate all the religions of the world and their beliefs and so forth. And this is what this new religious entity is going to be. Christian? Well, in name, it'll have some things from the past involved in it, but it'll incorporate every other error in there too. So everybody should be happy, right? Well, that's what this woman represents. She, in chapter 17, is the one who is dominating government, the revived Roman Empire. Now, the revived Roman Empire is powerful in its own sense, but this woman is going to be the one who has an influential say in that until the 10 kings of the revived Roman Empire who promoted her are then going to hate her and destroy her. So the religious entity is going to be destroyed. Now, why do we know that it's only the first half, the first 3.5 years of the 7-year tribulation that she's going to rule? Because the one who takes her place in chapter 13, this beast, who suffers a death wound and then is resuscitated into a worse monster than he was prior to his death, he is going to demand worship, and it tells us in chapter 13 of Revelation this is going to continue for 42 months or 3.5 years. So that means that the woman is squeezed into the first 3.5 years, and the beast, this world ruler, or this ruler who becomes a ruler worldwide, he doesn't start off that way, he's going to dominate the second half of the tribulation. So this woman is only there for the first half, and she's finally obliterated. Her power's taken away, and it says in chapter 17 that the kings of the earth even eat her. Well, they eat her by incorporating her adherents into this new religious system. And the 10 kings are promoting the one king. Now, we're going to get into that. Why do you have kings and king? How can you have this? Well, we're going to look at that in particular. We also looked at last week not only the woman, we reviewed the woman, but also the multi-headed beasts or systems. And we went, and we can do this quickly, in Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar sees an image, a beautiful statue made of different metals. And what it comes down to is this statue represents 4 different kingdoms. And the fourth kingdom has a division between what it originally is. It's made out of iron, and it's the feet, they're the legs, the feet and the toes are then made out of clay and iron. So that which is strong and that which is weak. That's a future extension. And we saw that the head was Babylon, the arms and the chest were Medo-Persia, the thighs were Greece, the legs were Rome, and the feet and the toes mixed with clay and iron is revived Rome. That's yet in the future. So there we have 5 different kingdoms. Then we went to Daniel chapter 7, and we see 4 beasts. And here again, the lion represents Babylon, the bear represents Medo-Persia, the leopard represents Greece, and this terrible beast represents Rome and future revived Rome. And the emphasis on the fourth beast in chapter 7 is not Rome historically, that we're all familiar with the Roman Empire, but it emphasizes Rome in the future with these 10 horns and this little horn. This hasn't taken place yet. And then in chapter 13 of Revelation, we saw a seven-headed beast. Now get that, a beast. He's the beast of Daniel chapter 7. But here he's showed with seven heads and ten horns. Now we're going to point out, when we come back to Daniel chapter 7, that the ten horns aren't distributed among the seven heads so that there's seven horns on seven of them and then three of them have two more horns. All ten are on the last head. All ten are on the last head. We hope to point that out because it's right here in Daniel chapter 7. So here you have a beast with seven heads and ten horns. You come to chapter 17 and the woman is riding a scarlet beast with seven heads and ten horns. And then in chapter 17 it says, and there's one more thing that hasn't been told yet. There's going to be one more head, an eighth head. And then we went back to chapter 12 of Revelation, and there was a dragon with seven heads and ten horns. Now what's the difference between the dragon with seven heads and ten horns and the beast with seven heads and ten horns? The dragon, in chapter 12, verse 3, is mentioned, and then in verse 11, he's identified as Satan. The heads are those realms of empirical government, of world powers that have existed in history when Israel was in or going toward the land. Now when I say going toward and in, that includes Egypt. The seven heads are these. Now in chapter 17 it says that five of these heads are fallen. These seven heads are kings. They're kings. Going back here to Revelation chapter 17, verse 10, and there are seven kings. These heads represents a place, a location where the woman sits. Seven mountains where the woman sits. We identified that historically, most probably with Rome. And the seven heads also represent, verse 10 of chapter 17, seven kings. Five are fallen. Egypt, where Israel was enslaved to them and then left Egypt. The Lord took them out of Egypt and they went into the land. Egypt was the power and it was decimated in the leaving by God when He took out Israel as they went to the promised land. So Egypt is that first head. The next head is Babylon. Babylon, Israel is in the land, and they take them captive. They take those from the southern two tribes captive. The northern ten tribes have already been taken captive into Assyria, but Assyria doesn't count as one of the heads in my understanding because you still have Jews within the land of Israel, even after the ten are taken away. But when the last two, when Benjamin and Judah are finally taken into Babylonian captivity, Babylon is the second head. And then the third head is Medo-Persian. Under the Medo-Persians, Cyrus sends them back into the land, while Medo-Persia is this world empire. The fourth empire is the one that destroyed or defeated Medo-Persia, and that's Greece, Alexander the Great. And he died young, and yet his four generals divided up that great landmass and ruled for centuries until the fifth beast, or the fifth head came into being, and that is Rome. And Rome defeated and dominated the Grecian Empire. Those are the five that are fallen. Then it says there's one that is, and one that is to come, and then there's an eighth beast. So there's three more heads. And what we've said is this, those last three are distinct from one another, and yet they all take place within the proximity of 7 to 8 years, the 7 years of the tribulation, and we'll throw in an extra year for that revived Roman Empire to be set up. Now, it might be more than that. We don't know. But in that proximity of time, there's going to be three distinct kingdoms, and we want to look at that as we look at the interaction between these ten horns and the little horn, or the ten horns and the man of sin, or the ten horns and the first beast of Revelation 13. So the first thing we want to look at before we start looking specifically at the head horn relation, or the horn relationship between the 10 and the 1 out of Daniel chapter 7, we want to look at some names that are given to the this final world ruler. Before we do that, let's try and clear up a problem that I think we have. It says in Revelation chapter 17 that in verse 10, there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, the other is not, and when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is, even he is the eighth, that is the eighth head, and is out of the seven and goes into perdition. Okay? And then it says in verse 12, and the ten horns which you saw are ten kings which have no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. In verse 12, you have ten kings, and in verse 8, you have the eighth head. And what does it call the heads back in verse 10? Kings. So the eighth head is a king, and you also have ten other kings. Now what's going on? Who's king? Well, if you remember back in the gospel records, on several occasions, one of them is Matthew chapter 2, verse 1, where Herod the Great is called king, King Herod. And then in John chapter 19, verse 15, when Pilate is trying to let Jesus go, and he calls Jesus their king, why do you want to put your king to death? They say what? We don't have any king but who? Herod? No! Caesar! Now what gives between King Herod and King Caesar? Well, King Herod is a lesser regional king compared to Caesar, who is the supreme overall empirical king. You see, you have two different levels of king, but they're both called king. And when we come to Revelation chapter 17, you have the eighth head. He's a king. He's the overall king. But you have ten lesser kings. So they're all kings. But they're kings on different levels. The ten are all on one level, and the eighth head is on a separate level. And they're all working together, and we want to look at that in a little bit. But first of all, let's look at the names, the scriptural names and descriptions for this final world ruler. In Daniel chapter 2, verse, I'm just going to go to 43. This is a description of the toes and the feet made of iron and clay. And there's an interesting comment in that dream as Daniel is given the interpretation, and he gives the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar. He says in verse 43, and whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay or brittle clay, they shall mingle themselves, that is, these toes shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. That phrase, the seed of men, the word man is one of really three, but two basic words in the Hebrew for man. First one where we know the word, the Hebrew word man. In fact, you know the Hebrew word for man, or one of the Hebrew words, and you might not have known it. Adam. Adam. And what Wilson's word study says is Adam means the common man as to his origin. The common man as to his origin. Then there's another word. It's the Hebrew word enosh. And enosh is defined as the common man as to his corruption. He's corrupt and weak. Guess which word is used here? The seed of an enosh. A common man who is corrupt and weak. What it's talking about is you have 10 kings of royalty, royal blood flowing in their veins. And then there's this other one that comes up along that's mixed in with them. And he doesn't have royal blood. And he never attains to that, nor does he need to attain to royalty, because he's going to surpass them. This one who's identified as the seed of Enosh, of common men who are corrupt and weak, he's the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. So one description of him is the clay. He's the clay of Daniel 2:43. In Daniel chapter 7, verses 8, 20, and 24, he's called the little horn. There's 10 horns, and it says in Daniel chapter 7, verse 24, that the 10 horns are 10 kings. We see the same thing when you get to Revelation chapter 17, verse 12, where it says the 10 horns are 10 kings. Well, I wonder if they're the same one. Well, it's pretty obvious that they're the same group. 10 horns. But in Daniel chapter 7, the 10 horns have a little horn that comes up among them, and he's more fierce than his fellows. And he has a mouth and eyes and a face of a man. He speaks great things. Not things you want to write down and remember and quote here and there, but great things against God. In fact, he's the one in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and that's the next place we go. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where he's called the man of sin in your English text. But the word sin isn't there. It isn't the word hamartia for sin. It's anomos, lawlessness. So it should be, he's the man of the lawlessness. And there's a definite article, the lawlessness. You know what the particular lawless act that he is known for? Well, if you read 2 Thessalonians 2:3, he sets himself in the temple, there's a definite, the temple of God, showing himself that he is a quality of God. And saying that there's no other God but himself. That's his act of lawlessness, the man of the lawlessness. So he's represented as clay, he's represented as the little horn, he's represented as the man of the lawlessness. In chapter 13, verses 1 through 7, he's represented as the first beast. Now, getting back to the seven horns, and you say, well, they're all kings. Which king is he? He's the last one. Well, then why mention six other ones? Because Satan, who is the one who's empowering, and it says that in chapter 13, verse 1, the dragon gives the throne and authority to this beast. The dragon is behind, and he incorporates all that he has desired and gleaned and gained and wants to pass on to the next kingdoms. And he takes all together those qualities of previous kingdoms and he puts them in to a new and improved and even more fierce version of what he has promoted before. That's why one beast, seven heads, he's the seventh head. He's going to be the eighth head after his death and resuscitation. He's going to be the eighth head. But as the seventh head, why is he the seventh? What does the other six have to do? All those characteristics of those previous kingdoms, Satan rolls up into this one guy at the end. That's why you have one beast, seven heads. That's why you have one dragon, Satan, seven heads. So he's called the first beast in Revelation chapter 13, 1 through 7. In Revelation 17, verse 8, he's called the beast that, and this is interesting because it's used three times in different ways, and we're not going to go over all the ways, but it's interesting because each one shows you a succession of what's happening. But in 17:8, he's called the beast that was and is not and yet is. He was, he lived. He is not, he was killed, and yet is, he was resuscitated. And by the way, we keep using the word resuscitation instead of resurrection, because why? It isn't permanent. Resurrection is permanent. This is only temporary. So he's resuscitated. Remember Mary and Martha's brother, Lazarus? He's resuscitated. He died again. Christ raised him, but not permanently. That's what happens to this world ruler. So he's called the beast that was and is not and yet is. The sixth thing that we see in the 11th verse of Revelation 17, he's called the eighth head. He's the head of the eighth empire. And it's coming on very quickly. Head number 6, head number 7, head number 8 are all wrapped up in over a 7 years' time, I'm going to say 8 years, it might be 9, 10, however long it takes for that revived Roman Empire once the church is gone. In fact, it might be that while we're still here, it's beginning to develop. We don't know, but it's not going to affect us because we're going to be gone. It might be developing, it may not. I don't know, and I'm not going to take a guess, and I don't need to. I know we're going to be out of here. But it's going to, those last three kingdoms are involved in a relatively short period of time compared to the previous five. So, in the 11th verse of Revelation 17, the eighth head is the eighth dominant world leader or ruler that comes on the scene. He's the resuscitated beast. Then we want to look at, before we start seeing their intermingling and how they work together, we want to see the scriptural occurrences of the 10 lesser kings, these 10 horns. In Daniel chapter 2, verse 40 through 43, as it mentions the clay, it mentions toes. How many? 10 toes. In Daniel chapter 7, verses 8, 20 and 24, we have three times it's mentioned 10 horns. 10 horns. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 3, we have the dragon who's the power behind all of these governments. He has 10 horns on one of his head. In chapter 13, verse 1, we have the beast with 10 horns on one of his head. And here it says these 10 horns have crowns. Two kinds of crowns. Victor's wreaths that are usually made out of like olive branches, kind of woven. You've seen pictures of the Greek Olympics and so forth, and that's what they would give as... by the way, I don't know what you do to put that in your trophy case. Kind of have to dip them in bronze or something like you do baby shoes to make them permanent because they're just going to get old brown and everything. But that was a victor's wreath. That's the one kind of a crown. Believers are going to get victor's wreaths, and they're more permanent. And they're going to be a type of crown that we cast at Christ's feet. You're the one responsible for any victories that you accomplish through us. We're simply the avenue, the vessel, and we had the privilege of allowing you. So if we qualify for crowns, it's because we allowed Him to do it through us. Those are victor's wreaths. Then there's another type of crown called a diadem. And a diadem is a crown that a potentate, a king, someone of government prominence would wear. A crown. These 10 horns in Revelation chapter 13, verse 1, are said to have 10 diadems. 10 diadems. So they're 10 kings, 10 genuine kings. And then we see in chapter 17, verse 3 and verse 12, we see the 10 horns are identified clearly as 10 kings. They're lesser kings who promote and exalt the greater king, the beast. Now as we continue on in chapter 17, we want to see the unfolding of these last three kingdoms. And so we're going to be looking primarily at four verses. Verses 10, 11, 12, and verse 17 to see how these 10 kings and this one king, the beast, the little horn, the man of the lawlessness, who's a greater king, he's the supreme king to these 10. We're going to see how they work together. All right? So as we look at verse 10, it says there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is and the other is not. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. It says that one is. There's five fallen and one is. When John is writing this, not back in the first century, but in his vision, he's seeing that this would be after the rapture. We'd see, most probably, we'd see that there are 10 kings. How many kings do you have over in Europe right now? I looked up the European Union. The common market started in about 1957 for the purpose of economic advantage for these European countries. And I know Bible scholars were always trying to reduce them or identify 10. So there were 10. You know how many are in the... Now, the common market has morphed into... the European Union. You know how many nations are in the European Union? 28. I don't know how it's going to happen, but of this area that has made up the old Roman Empire, whether it's absolutely exact boundaries of the old empire and that these nations will have their same exact boundaries, I don't know, but I do know this. There's going to be 10 potentates, kings, not presidents. I don't know if Charles will qualify as one of them, and as Britain might recognize the royalty again as simply not figurehead but rulers. But that's what it's going to go back to, is as they did in the 18th and 17th and centuries prior to that, they had actual royal families ruling Europe. It's going to go back to that. How? Put a gun to my head, I can't tell you. I don't know. But Scripture says it. There's going to be 10 kings, okay? And they're going to be kings, but it says in the 12th verse that they're 10 kings, but they haven't received a kingdom, a united kingdom yet. They're potentates in their own areas, but they haven't collectively entered into this time where they're together. So the sixth head is these 10 kings, and they're actual kings. They're actual blood royalty. In European, quote-unquote European countries. And then, these 10 kings, it says in verse 12, that they haven't received a kingdom as yet, but receive power or authority as kings 1 hour, and underline or circle this word, with the beast. With the beast, with the little horn. They're going to be with him. And by the way, this is going to be the seventh head. This is when these 10 kings who power coalesces, and this guy comes up among them within this revived Roman Empire, and they share their power with him. Why? I don't know. I think he's going to be the smartest, probably best looking, most intelligent, on and on in every area of governance that man has known. And they're going to welcome him to help them make a new and improved European state. Now, this all has to happen before the seven-year tribulation, or at least right near the beginning, because this man, the little horn, has to be involved, has to be sharing power with them in order to make a covenant with Israel for 7 years. And the seven-year covenant of Daniel 9:27 is the time clock for the seven-year tribulation. The 1 week, the one heptad, the one group of seven. And it has to be years by context. So here we have the kings, these 10 kings, coming to the fore, and then this fellow coming up to, and them sharing power in the first half of the tribulation. Then after he becomes the eighth head after his death and resuscitation in verse 11, then it says down in verse 17 that they're going to hate the religious harlot in verse 16 and destroy her. Verse 17, for God has put in their hearts, these kings' heart, to fulfill His will and to agree. And now it says, and to give, circle that, give their kingdom unto the beast. Wow. Now, for 42 months, he has the opportunity, this beast, he's going to try and coalesce his power worldwide, and he is not only the political power, he is the religious object of worship, all wrapped into one. Can you think of anybody that Scripture foretells that this will really happen to? God the Son, Jesus Christ. He's going to be the focus of power and worship when He comes back to earth. Now, quickly to verse 14. These, the kings, the ten kings, the lesser kings, and the beast, the supreme king, shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for He is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with Him are called and chosen and faithful. We're the ones coming with Him, with the Lamb, but the Lamb's going to do the fighting. We're just the observers. By the way, as believers today, don't go out and try and fight government. Don't go out and try and fight unrighteousness. You simply live righteously. Let Christ live through you and be a light in a dark world. Philippians and Ephesians talks about this. That's how we let Christ do that. He'll take care of the wrongs. When is He going to do that? Well, as it says here at the end of verse 17, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. You know, what's going on today in our society, and we see things crumbling and quote-unquote Christianity being disparaged and so forth, and really true believers and evangelicals, if you want to use that kind of a loose term and general term for true believers, or like I say, that is a loose term for true believers, but you see true righteousness being disparaged today in the news and in government and by courts and so forth. Righteousness is being punished and so forth. You know what? This is God's plan. Philippians 1:29, it's been given to you both to believe and to suffer for His sake. What should we expect? Anything less? We've been having it easy through the Beaver Cleaver era of this country and prior to that, from the setting up of this country and so forth. But the desires of those who are unbelievers finally come to the fore, and they're not going to put up, nor are they putting up with what they disagree with and what they don't like. So what are we supposed to do? Let the word of the Lord be fulfilled until His words, God's words, are fulfilled. He's demonstrating out through the lives of believers. If you let Christ live through your life and control you and not get out there and say, "You stand back, Lord. I'm going to fight this one for you." "Why, you dirty so-and-so, you think I am? Well, I tell you what you are." How many times do believers do that? Now, I know I'm overacting. I know that. But how many times do we attack those who are attacking us? You don't find that in Philippians chapter 1 about suffering for Christ's sake. Letting Him, His life, be demonstrated. Romans chapter 13, your enemy asks for food, needs food, you give him food. He needs something to drink, you give him drink. For in doing such, what do? You didn't knock him out. But in doing that, you put coals of fire upon his head. His mind is realizing what a schlup he is. I say that, and here I'm saying, you shouldn't say stuff like that, and then your pastor goes and says stuff like that on an unbeliever who's hateful of righteousness. That's what you do. It's the most effective testimony out there. It's been since the institution of the church. Suffering for Christ's sake and suffering correctly, suffering righteously. Here, now the 11 kings, the 10 lesser, the one supreme, as when Christ is coming back, verse 14, and it just mentions it here. We've seen His coming foretold earlier in the book of Revelation. We'll see it more specifically when we get to chapter 19. And in chapter 19, just with the word of His mouth, just by the sword of His mouth, just by what He speaks, He's going to destroy all opposition. He's going to literally slay, physically slay, all those armies who have been gathered together to fight one another, who have now turned their collective attention against the one coming. The in their minds, the alien who's our common enemy. And these two fighting factions, large fighting factions, are going to turn their attention. He's going to slay them with the word of His mouth. And you know what it says on His garment when He comes? King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now, it's interesting, in chapter 1, verse 5 of Revelation, it identifies Jesus Christ as it's introducing this prophecy. It's introducing Jesus Christ there. He's called the Prince or the Ruler of the kings of the earth. Is he the ruler of the kings of the earth today? Potentially, he has that, but he's not exercising that potential now. It's when he comes, then it's all going to change. And why is it going to change? Because everything that God has planned is going to be fulfilled. And so what are these people in the tribulation supposed to do? What are they supposed to do? Chapter 14 of Revelation. It says this also in chapter 13. It also mentions this, but in chapter 14, verse 11 and 12. Well, let's read from verse 9. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image and receive the mark in his forehead or in his hand, those who've chosen this world empire and its ruler, those who've chosen that, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture in the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends up forever and ever, and they shall have no rest day nor night who worship the beast in his image, whoever receives the mark of his name. And it says this, here is the patience of the saints. And they that keep the commandments of God, that's those Jewish commandments that are going to be instituted in the tribulation, and the faith of Jesus Christ, of Jesus. Patience. You know what that is? It's a word that means you're holding up. You're holding up under difficult circumstances. And it's Christ's life that can provide that ability to hold up under these difficult circumstances. Because God's going to set the record straight. When? When I ask Him to. Wrong. When His word is accomplished. When everything He's determined is accomplished. We're on a schedule, folks. The train's coming into the station on time. I can't see it. I can't even hear it. Must be the Doppler effect. Yeah, it's way out there. I can't hear it coming. But it's coming. This is all going to work out exactly according as God has planned it. And when it works out, where are we going to be, folks? We're going to be coming with Him. He's going to do all the work. We're going to see it happen. We're going to be watching. So what do we do until then? In the circumstances that we have, the suffering, Philippians 1:29, that has been given to us, we are to suffer patiently. We are to suffer with His life and character, letting Him live through us. I look out and I can see things that have happened, things that may be going through your lives right now, in your lives, in your experience and so forth. I look around here, things that will happen that we don't even know about. We're all candidates for difficulty. It's okay. God said in Romans 8:28, all things are working together for good. You think God doesn't know what He's doing? You think God doesn't know what He's allowing in our lives? If we forget that, that's what we're doing, is for either forgetting or looking at the wrong understanding of who God is, because He's got it all under control. Everything that's happening today, everything that will happen for the rest of this day, tomorrow, on to the days ahead, until we go home or Christ comes for the church. Either way, He knows exactly what He's doing and it's all on schedule. Heavenly Father, we're thankful that You have provided for us this understanding of Your program in times that are far more difficult collectively and intensively than what we normally go through as individual believers during this dispensation from the day of Pentecost till the rapture. And there are Christians who have suffered greatly, and there are Christians who are suffering right now in prisons, who are suffering death. And that's happened, Father, from the first century. Help us, those saints who are living in this country, not to think that we're immune, that it would never happen to us. We don't know. We can kind of see probabilities, but even so, Father, help us never to forget that there's a part of the family all over the world that are living under different circumstances, and our circumstances can change in a very short manner, very short time. So, Father, may we not look at the pleasantries or the unpleasantries, but in the God Yourself who is in control of what You allow into our lives. Father, You know exactly what's best. You've provided everything we need for life and godliness, according to 2 Peter chapter 1. May we be confident and renew that confidence as we look to Your Word again and again and be encouraged, Father, by these truths that we've been seeing here. The seven heads are historical. Five of them are. Three of them are yet to be. They'll happen one right after the other. Father, it's all going to play out according to the way that You have determined it. And we thank You for that. And we thank You for the provision that You'll give each of Your saints at the moment of need in each circumstance. Father, may we use Your provisions day by day in our circumstances, in the circumstances that we'll face even in these coming days. And we'll give You thanks once again from the standpoint of realization, that which is realizing that which is real and not that which physically, sensually looks, smells, tastes, hears, sounds like reality. Father, it's what Your Word, what You've declared in Your Word is absolute reality. Refresh our hearts day by day, as we look into Your Word to gain that sense of correctness. And we'll give You thanks again and again and again. Amen.